Do probiotics help for Clostridium difficile?
Can a clinician detect alcohol use, or is a questionnaire necessary?
Where's the best site for injection for those poor babies and their routine immunizations?
And how long does a cough actually last?
That's what we'll be talking about on this week's look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins and vice chairman of medicine at the University of Texas, San Antonio.
Rick, we're going to actually talk about two studies from a journal we have never talked about before, which seems amazing to me. That's Annals of Family Medicine. And I'd like to start out with this very timely one, at least for this part of the world. How long does a cough last?
As you mentioned, there are two very good clinical studies coming out of this journal. And the first one asks the simple question, how long does a cough last? And it's important because there are about 3 million outpatient visits in the United States each year in which the patient presents with just a complaint of cough. Now, most often, that's due to a viral bronchitis. So the real question is, for a routine viral bronchitis, how long does a cough last? If you poll patients, how long do they think it should last? So this was a study that looked at a population of 493 adults that had viral bronchitis and asked them, how long do you think this cough should last? And then it went to the literature to determine what the actual duration was. The cough lasted an average of 17.8 days just due to the viral illness. And it was interesting because when they polled the patients, their expectation was the cough would last just 5 to 7 days. Now, you know what the implications of this are, Elizabeth.
Sure. That means that everybody comes running back to their primary care doc and says, hey, I need an antibiotic because I've got this persistent cough.
And then what happens is they get the antibiotic, and over the next 7 days, their cough goes away, and it just reinforces their behavior. They say, oh my gosh, see, I wasn't getting better. I took the antibiotic, and in fact, I did get better.
It's so interesting. And of course, many of my colleagues, as I suggested already, are running around here with these very persistent coughs. We know that a lot of those are due to this irritation of these nerves, actually, that subserve that reflex. And nerves are famous for becoming irritated and waiting a long time before they chill.
You're right. Even after they've gotten rid of the systemic symptoms, they no longer have fevers or chills. They still have this persistent cough. So the message we need to be giving our patients is that it's normal to still be coughing 2 to 3 weeks after the onset of their illness. And they should only seek care if they have worsening symptoms. That's things such as a high fever, bloody sputum, or shortness of breath. Other than that, it'll run its course. It's a little bit longer than we typically expect, but it eventually goes away.
Okay, let's continue in the same journal, our newly discovered journal, and take a look at whether clinicians should use a questionnaire to assess whether patients are abusing alcohol.
About 15% of people in the United States have at least one episode of binge drinking in the last month, and about 10% meet the criteria for an alcohol use disorder. And we know that if the physician recognizes it and addresses it, we can significantly impact upon that drinking behavior, and we can decrease the hazardous drinking by about 40%. So the question is, when a physician sees a patient in the office, how good are they at determining, just based upon their clinical suspicion, whether they have hazardous or harmful drinking habits, or is it necessary to give a questionnaire? So in this particular study, there were 94 primary care clinicians, about 1,700 patients who completed a questionnaire after they saw the physician. The physicians were asked after they had seen these patients whether they thought they had a history of harmful or hazardous drinking, and then they compared that to the questionnaire. The physicians suspected that 5%, in fact, had either harmful or hazardous drinking patterns. Unfortunately, they were only able to pick up about 1 in 4 of the individuals that had harmful or hazardous drinking patterns. The questionnaires did a very good job of picking that up. This was just 5 simple questions. What it shows us is that routine use of a screening tool to supplement the clinician's suspicion is important.
Well, since alcohol use and abuse is such a common problem, it suggests to me that the utility of the screening questionnaire may very well be in its routine application.
Elizabeth, I think that's exactly right. If you just poll patients and ask a couple of questions, did the physician even ask you about your alcohol use? Only about 1/2 of patients would say, yes, they did. And then when they ask, did the physician ask you about safe drinking limits, or did the physician ask you to cut down? Only about 14% of patients said that the physician even talked to them about safe drinking limits, and only 7% were advised to cut down. So I think you're right. This should be a routine part of the patient's visit.
Okay. Let's move to pediatrics. an issue that affects many parents. I recall this very well. What is the best site to give these poor infants routine immunizations?
Kids have a number of immunizations, and when you bring your child in the physician's office, the physician says, would you like the vaccine given in the arm or the leg? And I have to admit, I was kind of clueless about, gosh, is there really a difference between the two? And then we know there's really no difference in terms of the ability to immunize the individual. But the real question is, are there differences in the local reactions? And that's what this study addressed. They looked at 1.4 million children who received 6 million different intramuscular vaccines. Again, routine vaccines recommended for children. These were all children between 12 months and 6 years of age. And they ask, how often does a child come back seeking care for a local reaction problem? And what they determined was that injection in the thigh is associated with a significantly lower risk of a local reaction to the DTP vaccine. Now, the influenza and hepatitis didn't matter. More so for children under the age of 3 years.
Well, all I can say is I used to really not enjoy taking my daughters for routine immunizations. It'd be great if we could come up with something other than injections.
Unfortunately, nothing as effective as vaccines at this time.
But stay tuned. Finally, then, let's turn to the New England Journal of Medicine, a topic we've talked about before, the utility of probiotics, those mixtures of stuff that are ostensibly going to repopulate the gut. In this case, whether that's helpful for that very, very nasty bug, Clostridium difficile.
We've talked about the use of probiotics usually contained in food products. This is an unusual probiotic administration. That is using fecal material to reconstitute the gut in people that have had recurrent C. diff infections. We've talked before about how significant this disease is, especially in the older population, and in certain subsets can be lethal. We know that antibiotics are unable to induce a durable response in about 1 in 6 or 1 in 4 individuals. And we usually end up treating those individuals with higher doses of antibiotics or a longer duration of antibiotics. But even in those individuals, repeat treatment is only effective about 60% of the time. But it has been suggested that probiotics could be useful. And that's what this study addressed. It took 42 individuals that had recurrent C. diff infection and randomized them to two arms that received high-dose antibiotics. And the third arm received antibiotics followed by infusion of fecal material into the duodenum. Now, what they did was they screened donors, and after they were shown to have no infectious diseases and to be healthy, they collected their stool, mixed it up in a solution, filtered it, and then took what was left over and actually infused it into a tube into their duodenum. And what they discovered was the individuals that had the duodenal infusion of donor feces had an 81% resolution rate. Of the 16 individuals, 13 had resolution of C. diff associated diarrhea after the first infusion, 3 had a second infusion, and 2 of them responded. So the response rate was 94%. Compare that to the response rate of about 23% in those that received routine antibiotics.
And how durable was this response?
They defined response as resolution of diarrhea and not being able to detect C. diff for at least 10 weeks. They even went a step further and they measured the microflora in these individuals that had the fecal infusion. And what they demonstrated was that they were able to reconstitute the normal bacterial flora. For those that received antibiotics, that was not the case.
Of course, we've been working our way into a strategy like this for some time. There have been fecal transplants that have been attempted also to resolve Clostridium difficile infection. What's your view of this matter? How do we screen people so that they can be donors and appropriately screen people who might be recipients?
The nice thing about this article is it goes into great detail about what sort of things they screen for. And these are very easy things to screen for. So they collect some stool and look for ova and parasites, for example. They do blood tests to make sure that the patients don't have any HIV infection or hepatitis infection. So the donor screening is using routine tests that were currently available. The manner in which the stool was processed is also very easy to do as well. So this, although it sounds very unappealing, I mean, if you tell someone, gosh, you have this C. diff, and want to give you fecal infusion, they say, my gosh, I'm not going to drink that solution. Well, you don't drink it. It goes in an NG tube. You really never even see it or don't taste it. It is incredibly effective against a disease that's been relatively resistant to even high-dose antibiotics. So, Elizabeth, of the studies we've talked about, which do you want to highlight on our blog this week?
I'm going to do the study on how long does a cough last, both for the fact that it highlights a new journal, one that we haven't talked about before, and also for the many friends, family, and colleagues who do have persistent coughs right now and think that they might be in trouble.
All right, I'm for it. Let's put it on the blog.
Okay, so that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.